PRX. This is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Jennifer Hickson. The Moth is true stories told live by people all over the world. In this hour, we're going to focus on one mitten-shaped region of the United States. That's right, Michigan, home of monthly Moth Story Slams in both Detroit, where we partner with WDET, and Ann Arbor, where we partner with Michigan Public Radio. Story Slams are our open mic competitions where folks get 5 minutes to tell stories based on a predetermined theme. In this hour, you'll hear two slam stories and two stories that were born out of stories we first heard at the slam. So, to be clear, you don't need to be a fan of Tigers, Lions, Red Wings, Pistons, or Wolverines to appreciate these stories. They could probably take place in your hometown. We'll start with this story from Dame Wilburn, who showed up at our Detroit Story Slam. The moment I heard her, I thought, this woman is a force, and I want to get her on the Moth main stage. A year later, she and I worked on something, and here it is. Dame Wilburn, live at the Moth.
So my friend and I are driving around Detroit looking for something to do. And this is a problem, because my friend Mark is the kind of person who will say to you, if you get a tattoo, I'll pay for it. So that means all kinds of things could possibly happen right now. And while we're driving, we are on 8 Mile and Gratiot. Those of you who live near Detroit, note the sound. Yes, exactly. And we come across a gypsy fortune teller. And we decide, why not? So we go in the gypsy fortune teller, and the gypsy comes out and looks at the two of us and says, you go first. So she points to Mark, and Mark goes first. And I'm sitting there, and I'm trying to figure out, well, I should probably have a question. You know, I don't want, like, random information about my life. I don't live the kind of life where I want to know what's going to happen. It's probably best that that just sneaks up on me. So, because the stuff so far has been out of control. So I'm sitting there, and I think, well, really, the only question I have is, am I ever going to find love? Because right now, I'm 28 years old and I'm not in a relationship. I lost my virginity at 26. And yeah, because you should sigh at that, because Mormons lose it at 20. Okay, so I'm actually destroying the sex bell curve for everybody. So, but sitting there, I'm like, well, you know, if you're gonna do this, you probably should be honest. Okay. So I'm not really trying to figure out if I'm ever going to find love. That's a really broad thing. I'm trying to figure out, the question I have is, will Mark ever fall in love with me? Because let's face it, I'm hanging out with him because of that. But anyhow, Mark comes out of the door, and the gypsy says, okay, you're next. And I stand up, and as I'm walking towards the door, she locks me in a gaze and says, you're cursed. You're cursed. This is, you're cursed to never find love. You're cursed. This is the worst curse I have ever, your whole family's cursed. This is generational. This, I've never seen a, I haven't gotten in the room yet. I've never seen a curse like this in my life. I get in the room. She, still, I am floored by the level of curse that's hanging on you. And no cards have moved. No cards have moved. And I'm standing there, and I gotta tell you, I'm pretty excited about this, because all these years, I thought it was me. I thought, you know, it's like, I'm 28, I didn't lose my virginity until I was 26. I thought I was too loud, too fat, too black, too whatever. But if I'm just cursed, hallelujah, yes, that means we can fix it, you know? I am obviously a problem in search of a solution. All right, here we go. So she starts to talk to me. She's taking the cards down, and as the cards go down, if anything, the curse is going further back and getting worse. Like, it's, so every card that goes down, she's just confirming what she's already said. So she looks at me and she says, okay, you're uber cursed, and I can fix it. And I'm like, yes. And she says, we're going to get some candles together. I'm going to light some incense. I'm going to say some prayers. Nice. I like how you're thinking. And she just starts to list all this stuff off. And she says, and I can do all of this for you, but it's going to cost you $5,000. Okay, now I'm mad. Okay, because I'm from Detroit and you are trying to hustle a hustler. All right? We do this game in the D every day, and you think that I'm gonna give you $5,000 to lift a curse. I'm gonna get right on that. Top of my list of things to do next. So we pay the gypsy fortune teller and we leave. And as we're driving away, I'm thinking to myself, yeah, but you know, like 26, you might really be cursed, you know? But I don't have $5,000. So I'm thinking all of this through. And it dawns on me, well, I'm gonna have, the only way I can lift this curse is I'm gonna have to do it myself. And the only way to do it myself is I'm gonna have to become a witch. Nothing I can do. There's nothing I can do. What are my options? What are my options? If you can't afford a doctor, you have to become a doctor. What's your option? If people could afford doctors, WebMD wouldn't exist. What's your option? Right. So I'm like, fine, I'll become a witch. Now, here's the thing about me. I don't think that smart people are smarter than me. I think they read a book I didn't read. So, this whole thing has got to be in a book, right? This has got to be in a book. So I start trying to find information, and the first place you go is online, right? So I've got the internet, I've got the Google, right? So I'm typing in witchcraft, hex breaking, all of that. And all this information is coming back, but I don't understand it. I can't seem to wrap my brain around how this works. So I flash back to college. And in college, if you don't know something, you take a class, right? You take a course. So I'm saying to myself, well, obviously, I just need to find like a witchcraft class. Like, so how, I'm in Michigan, how hard could that be? So I'm driving around one day after work, and this commercial comes on, and it says, metaphysical bookstore, classes, Wicca 101 classes, and I'm like, perfect. But I don't have a pen, I can't write it down, so I drive over to the building to sign up for Wicca 101. For those of you who are familiar with the hero's journey, there is always an obstacle. I'd like to describe to you my first obstacle. So I walk in the bookstore, and sitting at the counter in this metaphysical bookstore is what I really can only describe him as, Satan's valet. All right? This guy has jet black hair that goes from the top of his head to the back of his knees, except for an inch of hair from the part here, which is silver. Apparently, magicians can't use hair dye. So he is wearing Benjamin Franklin sunglasses. He is wearing what I will refer to as the theory of a sweater, because there really wasn't enough yarn in it to be a sweater, but he thinks it's a sweater, and I'm in no position to argue that. And this is my favorite touch to everything about him, he is drinking what I will later discover is cognac out of a Hogwarts mug. Now, my family is Baptist, right? Not up here Baptist, where people get out of church in less than 8 hours, but like Georgia Baptist, like every day in church Baptist, right? So I look at this guy, and all I can hear are my uncles, who are all preachers, beginning with, the wages of sin is death. That is death before you. And I'm like, this is true. Okay, and this guy scares the hell out of me, and I'm gonna leave. And then the voice in my head says, you were 26! And you don't have $5,000. And I'm not waiting another 26 years. All right, well, there you go, motivation. So I get to the counter, I say I wanna sign up for the Wicca 101 class, Wicca 101 classes. He runs off, grabs a pen, signs me up, and I start taking these classes. I ask him, you know, hey, is there a book I'm supposed to read or anything? And he sort of recommends a few, not, you know, few books, Most of them are arcane knowledge that to this day I don't understand. But one book sticks out. And I began to hang out with the community, and I began to do spell work, right? So the purpose of Wicca, if for those of you who don't know, and I'm sure that's probably all of you, the purpose of Wicca is to know thyself. So it's not really about doing magic to change this out here, it's about changing you. That's the purpose. So instead of doing all this magic to make the world accept me, I start doing the work to accept myself. And I'm doing spell work for that. And one of the pieces of spell work I do is to be open to love in all of its forms. No matter what form it shows up in, just be open, right? So it just so happens that as I'm working with the community, the author of the book that finally made me understand Wicca is doing a fundraiser, right? Pagans have fundraisers, okay? Churches have fundraisers. Guys who golf have fundraisers. We have fundraisers. There is a difference between, you know, like a fundraiser, you know, I don't know, here in Ann Arbor where people have money, and a pagan fundraiser in Downriver, Michigan. Probably the thing that you need to know is that nobody in this room at this fundraiser has any money, but you don't know that because they're all dressed like Gandalf the Grey. They're wearing so much stuff that you're like, well, obviously you have some cash to buy that. That tree you're walking around with alone has got to be like $100. Also, these are all my friends. I love them. Some of them are here tonight, but they're not the most financially savvy folks in the world. But these are the kind of people who won't pay a gas bill because they need a new hat. So fundraisers can be challenging in the pagan world. But I'm at this fundraiser, and I'm sitting at a table, and I look out, and this woman is walking across the room, and all the lights seem to go out, and all the people in the room seem to disappear, and all I can see is her. Now, this could have been a romantic moment, except that voice in the back of my head says, you're black, you're a woman, you're a pagan. Are you sure you're going to just add lesbian to that list? Like, you know, like, this isn't, you know, like, this isn't Pokemon. You ain't got to catch them all, you know? But I keep looking at her and I'm thinking, yeah, I'm probably going to have to add lesbian to that list. And I'm also thinking, this conversation with my mother is going to top the pagan conversation by a country mile. Easy, easy. So this incredible woman sits down next to me and starts flirting with me, which I'm shocked by. I flirt back. Bell curve, I'm super shocked by that. My flirting is working. I'm terrified by that. And the whole time that I'm sort of talking to her, but trying to talk myself out of talking to her, the spell work that I've been doing pops up. And the spell work was be open to love in all its forms. So you might as well be open. So 10 years later, I'm not to anything. I am married to that woman that walked across the room. At no point did it cost me $5,000. And believe me when I tell you, I can lift one hell of a curse. Thank you.
That was Dame Wilbur. She's a community educator in Detroit. She and her wife, Celeste, live in a rambling house with their four dogs. But she said something about the formality of telling a moth story helped her look within and decide she wants to be a writer as well. Not sure if a magic wand was involved, just that she put the plan in action and she's currently working on her first book. To see a picture of Dame and her wife, visit our Radio Extras page at themoth.org. Now I want to introduce you to someone very important to The Moth in Michigan, Patty Wheeler. She is our local Story Slam producer, which means she shepherds the Story Slams. She manages the host and crew and is our moth on the ground on show nights. She's one part showrunner, one part den mother, one part problem solver. Now, one of the things that regional producers do is flag the best stories and interesting storytellers for those of us back at headquarters. I got Patty on the phone and we talked about Dame Wilbur the first time she saw her at a slam.
I take notes on what the stories are about when the storytellers are telling, and I didn't, because I couldn't stop watching her. She was so dynamic and so full of life and excitement, and everybody was just laughing their heads off and totally attentive at the same time. It was, I think, what sometimes we call the storyteller's trance happened, where everybody was on the same page with her. And every time she gets up there and tells a story, it's the same thing. And she just has this connection to people that is just, it's totally wonderful.
She is fun to watch and fun to hear. Yeah.
She's so animated and just, and excited, and she talks about things in a way that is so totally real and universal, even though most of us aren't lesbian Wiccans. It's really, I feel like, okay, yeah, I get it when she's talking, which is so, it's so fun.
Tell me how you first came to the Moth Story Slam.
I first heard about the Moth on the radio, from WDET, actually. So I heard the radio hour, and then there was a spot for Ask for Volunteers, and that was how I got hooked.
And what's your day job, Patty?
I am an event planner. Besides Story Slams, I plan weddings and birthday parties and corporate events and all of that kind of thing.
And are you a lifelong Michigan girl? Did you grow up there?
Yeah, I grew up there. I've lived in several other places, but Michigan, I have a tattoo of Michigan on my arm, so I can't really get away.
Each of the Moth's 25 Story Slam cities have their own regional producers. A tattoo of their home state is not a requirement, but doesn't hurt. Whenever I talk to storytellers from Michigan, they're all sure to mention that they absolutely love Patty. The Moth was lucky to find her. Coming up, a stay-at-home mother starts to feel her nest getting empty and ponders her next move.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson. And now for another Michigan story. This one was told at a main stage show in Lansing. Here's Tina Zimmerman live at the Moth.
Back in 2007, my third child was in her senior year of high school, and we were celebrating all of her last things. The last football game where she would march with the marching band, her last school play, her last high school concert. I was so proud of her and proud of all of my kids. But while I was very proud of her, I had this growing sense of dread for myself. I did not know what was going to come next in my life. I had been a stay-at-home mom for 22 years, which puts me in a special class of dinosaur. There aren't many of us who do that anymore. I loved everything about being a mom. I loved having babies. People warn you about the terrible twos and about the teenage years. And to be really honest, I loved all that too. Not every day, but I loved every phase of it. I loved being a mom. Along with being a mom, I was also one of those people who volunteered myself all around my kids. I was the Girl Scout leader. I helped to run the Sunday school. I surrounded myself with other mothers so that we had this sense of community. It was a thing I filled my life with, being a mom, and I just loved it. During this time, though, I had lost my confidence, really. I knew I could do stuff at home, but I became convinced that I wasn't smart enough, that I wasn't good enough to do anything else outside of my house. We had one of those houses where the kids just would come through. My daughters always had their friends over. We had a steady parade of kids and teenagers over those years. We had the privilege of seeing a lot of them get launched into their lives. We had genuine affection for a whole lot of kids. And I knew that with this third child graduating, that my house was about to get a whole lot quieter. And I was in a panic about that. People had suggested to me for a while that I should go into the ministry. And, well, that scared the hell out of me, really. It meant graduate school, seminary, and I really was not a very stellar student the first time around. And I wasn't feeling like I was smart enough to handle any of that. It also meant that I was going to have to hang around with all those holy people. And I really wasn't that. It meant I'd have to clean up my vocabulary a little. Like I'd have to give up my love of a good dirty joke every now and again. But ministry is big. I mean, when you screw up in ministry, you can screw up really big time. This is people's relationship with God. This is their faith. I just wasn't smart enough. I wasn't holy enough. I wasn't good enough to do that. And here's an example. There was a boy who lived across the street, a young man who was in my daughter's circle of friends. This kid's name was Travis, and I really liked him. He was one of those deep-thinking kids. He had been in and out of my house along with dozens and dozens of others. I liked him a lot. He had blue hair. And Travis had come to a crisis in his life. I knew that what was going on at his house that spring was very different than what was going on at my house. We were joyfully celebrating my third daughter, but Travis had come to a crisis in his life, and he had tried to commit suicide. And he spent some amount of days in the hospital. We live in a small town. There aren't many secrets. And I knew that they were going through a terrible time over there. And I thought, this is what people do in the ministry. They're with other people who are going through dreadful times. And the thought of a child in danger, trying to commit suicide, that was unthinkable to me. How could I ever step into that situation? I just wasn't smart enough. On the night of my daughter's last band concert, my husband was out of the country, and my daughters had gone off with their friends that night, and I was sitting home alone after that concert, and I was in a panic. What is going to happen next? What am I going to do next? My house, my life is about to get a whole lot quieter. And I did not know what I was going to do. And as I was sitting there, I heard a familiar sound, the sound of squealing tires. I live out in the country. We live on a paved road, but north of our house, the curve is sharp, and people tend to take that curve too fast. We had had lots of people take that curve too fast and go off the road, and usually they'd end up in the cornfield north of our house, or they'd end up off in the ditch. So when I heard that squealing of tires, it was familiar to me, and I flinched, and I waited for the inevitable crash. And it came, only this time, it was really loud. I got up off the couch, and I stepped out onto my porch, and there in front of me was a wrecked car, not 5 or 6 steps ahead of where I was standing, and I said, "Oh, my God." It was right there, and the driver's side was pinned up against a large maple tree. The first step seemed to take me forever to get down, but I don't remember any of the steps after that. I was down to that car. I looked in the passenger seat, and there was a man inside, and he had one hand still on the steering wheel and one hand slung across the passenger seat and his head slightly back. He looked like he was just on a leisurely drive home. And I said, "Sir, are you okay? Talk to me. Come on, tell me, are you okay?" And he didn't move. He didn't say anything. I stood up and I looked across the road, and there I spotted Travis's blue hair, Travis coming out of his house and his mother right behind him, and all my other neighbors coming out of all of their houses. And I hollered across the road, "Call 911, this is a really bad one." And I bent down, and I looked in the passenger seat, and I laid my hand on his arm, and I shook him, and I said, "Come on, mister, talk to me. Wake up. Come on, don't go to sleep now." And he didn't move. And I stood up again, and Travis and all of my neighbors were in my yard, and it was chaotic. And Travis was talking on his cell phone. He was the only one of us who had a cell phone. And the adults were shouting at him, "Tell them he's non-responsive. Tell them to hurry. This is really bad." And Travis was calmly talking into that phone as the adults were running around in the chaos. I made eye contact with him for just a second, and I just watched him. I bent down in the car. I looked across, and I held that man's hand, and I said, "Come on, mister, wake up. Come on, talk to me." And I pulled my hand back, and it was covered with blood. And there on the passenger seat, I noticed that the blood was pooling as it was dripping down off of his fingers. And I thought, he's not coming back. I laid my hand on his arm, and I said something I had never said before. I said, go to God, go in peace. And at that moment, I felt a weight lift off of me. It floated up as if I could look up and see something floating above me. And I felt light. And in the distance, I could hear the sirens coming. For much of the rest of that evening, I sat on my front porch as the volunteer fire department came, and then the paramedics came, and then the coroner came. And in that time, I thought to myself, I'm going to do this. I'm going to be a pastor. I'm going to seminary. I'm going to go. I'm going to do this whole thing. God is calling me, and I am going to do it. This is my time to do this. We later found out that that gentleman's name was Rudy, and he was 34 years old. What if the last horrific thing that happened in Rudy's life was matched by the lesson learned by a blue-haired young man that life is precious? What if the last horrific thing in Rudy's life was the turning point for a middle-aged housewife? Wouldn't that be something? Just 10 days ago, after 7 years of being in process with my church, and included 5 years of seminary at night and on the weekends and in the summers, after countless papers had been written and a lot of language cleaned up, a lot of reflection and examination, just 10 days ago, I knelt down and the bishop laid her hands on me, and she said that I was ordained. Thank you.
That was Tina Zimmerman. She's now a reverend at the United Methodist Church in Manchester, Michigan, and a chaplain at a local retirement community. The large maple tree in Tina's front yard still stands, and to this day has a big scar from where it was hit. As for the blue-haired boy, Tina's happy to report that he's thriving, successful, and quite happy. To see a picture of Tina at her ordination, visit themoth.org. Next up, two slam stories with an interesting connection from a recent Michigan Grand Slam.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
You're listening to the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson. Next, we're going to hear two stories from the same Michigan Grand Slam. Both stories have a connection to autism. First up is Eddie Haka. He's a frequent storyteller at the Detroit Story Slam, and a lot of his stories focus on his kids. He's raised quite a few. Here's Eddie.
Sesame Street nearly killed our son. I'm not kidding. Our oldest son, Sam, has autism and Tourette's, and as a result, he has powerful obsessions and compulsions that were even stronger when he was little. And some of them were episodic, one-time things that he had to do and he had to do now, like go over the barrier at the gorilla enclosure at the zoo, go over the fence on the edge of a 200-foot fall into Lake Superior, wander off at sunset in the Porcupine Mountains. Now, others were more periodic, things he had to do every single day for a period of like 6 months, a year and a half. Though to the rest of the family, each of them seemed to go on forever. Some were harmless, like the one school year he wore a Band-Aid on his face every single day. And others were a little more frightening, like the stretch where he had to run out and touch a yellow line in the road with his finger to a count of four, one, two, three, four. And of course, it's a yellow line, so therefore it was a busy street, like Grand River or Michigan Avenue. And you couldn't stop him. The best you could do is protect him. Though there was many a friend and family and total stranger who told us over the years when he'd behave like this or any number of other unusual behaviors or utterances, why do you let him do that? Why don't you just tell him to stop? Now, granted, 20 years ago, the awareness of autism was not as great as it is now, let alone Tourette's, but this combination of the two led to these obsessions and compulsions that were so strong, it was like an itch that if you didn't scratch it, just grew stronger and stronger and stronger. And he could easily take off while I'm cooking dinner or we're all asleep. So our best course of action was just to protect him, and we survived that compulsion with no casualties. And we moved to the next, and he moved to the next, and there was one when he was about 8 years old that I completely misunderstood. In autism, there's this saying, behavior is communication. Well, this one went right over my head. He was compulsively taking the wire ties that connect your chain link fence to the, you know, the upright supports in the top bar. They're bent and then they're crimped with pliers, but he was using his little 8-year-old fingers to wiggle them back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, so he could get it loose and take it off. And it was taking him forever, but he was working his way down the fence, and every couple weeks, I'd go out at night with my pliers and I'd put them all back on. But Sam was not our only child. Over the years, my wife and I, we've raised in our home 17 children. And at that time, we had 5 other children. And so, you know, between work and coaching and all the needs of all the other children, I fell behind his compulsion, and it was my fault. But one day, I look out the back window, and I see the fence between our house and the Walkers, the best next-door neighbors ever, lying flat in the grass. And the top pole is missing. And I look out in the back of the yard at the edge of the garage by the power lines is Sammy with a 20-foot-long pole wobbling. And I was like, shit. I go out there, and we've learned over the years, you can't panic, you can't yell. That only makes a bad situation and makes it worse. So I said, Sammy, let me have the pole. Give Tata the pole, Sammy. But before I could get a hold of it, he goes, wham, wham. And you know that gray cylindrical box attached to the utility pole where the power line goes in? He hits it twice really hard. And as he hits it, he yells, Oscar, come out of you can! Come out of you garbage can, Oscar! He thought the transformer was Oscar's garbage can. And all this time, I thought his compulsion was bending those wires. But no, it was a singular compulsion with a singular purpose. You know, he looked up, Oscar's up there, about 20 feet high, need about a 20-foot length of pipe. Well, there's one right there. That'll work. I said, Sammy, Oscar doesn't live up there. Oscar lives on the ground. He live on the ground? Yes, he lives on the ground. He live on the ground? Yes, he lives on the ground. He live on the ground. You got to do things in fours, right? And so I said, if you hit that, you could die. I could die. You could die. I could die. You could die. I could die. So 45 minutes later, I've convinced him to come inside and see the Sesame Street video and show him that Oscar does, indeed, live on the ground. but I'm not foolish enough to think I've talked him out of his compulsion. So my wife comes home, I run to the fencing store, buy 3 big bundles of those wire ties, and that night, the rest of us go out there, we put so many wire ties on that fence, he'd have to have that obsession for another year before he had another chance to talk to Oscar. Now, surviving these compulsions and just navigating Sammy's diagnoses over the last 20-some years have taught my wife and I and most of our kids to take life in stride and appreciate and enjoy all the little things. And my wife summed it up beautifully in one of our many camping trips. It had been another fun but eventful day. The kids were all finally asleep in their tents. She and I were sitting around the fire having a well-deserved nightcap in our little tin cups. And she looks up at me and says, "Honey, it was a good day. No fatalities."
That was Eddie Haka. Eddie's a special education teacher and union representative. Since he started coming to the Moth, he's told several stories about his son Sammy and others in his extraordinarily large family, 17 children and counting, 2 by birth, 9 foster children, 5 of whom they adopted, and 6 others who they parented outside the system. In all his stories, Eddie is always sure to give credit to his exceptional wife, Michelle, who happens to be our next storyteller. Now, it's unusual for married couples to be in the same competition, but it sometimes happens. A Moth Story Slam, after all, does make for a pretty fun night out. Here's our Michigan Slam producer, Patty Wheeler, again, to explain how this married couple ended up in the same Grand Slam.
Eddie went first, and he got really high scores, and it was lovely. And then Michelle went last, but nobody really realized that they were together. And she got scored really high, and then when I was about to announce the winner, I realized that they had scored the exact same scores, and both had won. They had tied to win. And when we have a tie at the Moth, we have several different ways that we break that tie. But Eddie said, "No, I don't want to do that. I want Michelle to be able to go to the Grand Slam," and everybody cried, and it was really spectacular.
In the end, we found a way to include both Eddie and Michelle in the same Grand Slam. So here's Michelle Fechteau live at the Grand Slam in Detroit.
All right, so it's March 20th, 1990, and I'm working as a health and safety union rep for the International Lady Garment Workers Union in Manhattan on Broadway and 53rd, right near Central Park. And I'm working late, because I always work late, and I get a phone call from Ruben, the security guard, and I don't usually get calls from him. And he calls me and he says, "There's a guy in the lobby and he wants to see you. He says he knows you." And I'm like, "What's his name?" He said, "Richard Price." I'm thinking, "Richard Price? I don't know a Richard Price." He said, "Well, he's got a letter from you, and it's laminated." I said, "Laminated?" And so I was very confused, and he said, "Well, the letter says you sent him some books on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire." And then I remembered there was this letter that no one wanted to answer, but I was low seniority, so they gave it, you know, my boss gave it to me to answer. And it was a guy named Richard Price from Three Rivers, Michigan. And he was somebody who, by the letter, you could tell he was really different. He talked about his obsession with the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and how much it meant to him. Now, if you don't know the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, it's a big moment in labor history, especially for the Garment Workers Union. It was in 1911, March 25th, in Lower Manhattan. The Ash Building, the 3 top floors, was a sweatshop, and a rag caught on fire and went through the whole shop. And there was 146, mostly young immigrant women, teenagers, who were killed in that fire because the owner of the sweatshop kept the doors locked to keep the theft down, had unworking elevators, and the firefighters, their ladders only went to the floor right below them. So these women were burned and jumped. Many of them jumped to their death. So it was a very traumatic thing, but it brought about a lot of change in health and safety, and it really spurred the International Lady Garment Workers Union. So he was really into this, and he told me how he had even done a big display about it at the Three Rivers Public Library and then gotten the library cited for fire code violations. And he told, in the letter he said he'd gotten a lot of the businesses in Three Rivers cited for fire code violations. So, you know, he was different. And I was sort of struck by it, and I sent him some books on the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire and a nice letter thanking him for his interest, and I didn't think anything of it. And I didn't even think anything of it when the mayor of Three Rivers called me a little while later and said, you know, Richard Price, just want to let you know, he's a good guy, the community really loves him, even though he keeps writing people up and getting them cited for fire code violations, you know, and so... And I vaguely remembered him saying he was going to come for the 79th anniversary of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire on March 25th. So I went down to the lobby, and there he was. He was a big guy in his mid-20s. He had his buttons, his flannel shirt all buttoned all the way to the top, and he had a coat on. It was, like, you know, crooked, and a backpack. And I looked at him, and you could tell he thought it was really important, but he looked down at the ground. He wouldn't look me in the eye. He just looked really bashful and adorable. And I asked him, you know, how did you get here? Where are you staying? And he said, well, I shoveled driveways all winter long in Three Rivers, Michigan, so I had enough money to get a round-trip train ticket here and an extra $100. I said, so all you got is $100? He said, yeah. I said, where are you staying? He goes, well, last night I slept on a park bench in Central Park. And I was like, oh, no. Because in 1990s New York, it was the crack epidemic was still raging, and there was, homeless people getting hurt all the time. And in fact, I remembered that someone had been burned on the park bench in Central Park not that long before. So I was like, oh no, I can't have this. So I start calling people and friends and shelters, and there's nothing available. And so I call my husband. Now, we had only been married a couple of years, and we had a tiny little place in the Bronx, 250 square feet maybe, and the smaller half of a second floor of a house. And I called my husband, and I told him the story, and he said, can I bring him home? And he said, of course, which is why I love him so much. But Ruben, the security guard, who was also off-duty cop, he said, Michelle, are you sure? You don't know this guy. You got a little baby at home. I had a 9-month-old baby at home, and he knew it. He had seen me walking pregnant all the time. And I knew that baby was there, and he goes, are you really sure? And my friends who came out said, Michelle, you're crazy. This doesn't make sense. Don't do it. But I had made up my mind. I'm doing it. There's no other alternative. I'm not letting him sleep in a park bench in Central Park. So I brought him home, and you know what? We had an awesome time. We had a great time. We showed him how to go around New York. We took him out. We even took him some friends of ours, a local union in Manhattan. He learned how to merengue. He learned how to salsa. He ate Puerto Rican food. But the best part of the week is when I took him to the anniversary of the memorial of the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire. It was in front of the Ash Building where the fire had occurred. He met all of these union dignitaries. He even met some of the descendants of people who had died in the fire. And he was beaming. And I was just basking in his happiness and felt so good. And he went home. We got him on the train back. And then a few days later, I get this call from the executive vice president's office on the top floor. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe she's noticing all these late hours I'm working. But no. That wasn't it. I go up there, and she lit into me. And you know what she said? She said I was irresponsible. She said I put my son at risk. What kind of mother was I? She said, what kind of a person would put the union at risk? You're making us liable. And I thought she was going to fire me, but I was crying so hard that I think she just felt sorry for me. So she said, if you ever do this again, you will be fired. And I bit my tongue because I was sole support. My husband was a stay-at-home dad, and I needed that job. So I know now that Richard had autism. You know, the way he was obsessed with a certain subject, the way he looked down and wouldn't look in the face, and the way he didn't seem to care if he got his neighbors written up for fire code violations. But I think about it, and I know this because that little baby that everyone cared so much about, he's the same age as Richard now, and he has autism. That's my son, the one Eddie Haka told you about. And so I ask you, when you see somebody on the street, maybe they need help, maybe they're just passing by, people might say they're crazy, might seem different, please be kind. Treat them like it could be your own son. Thank you.
That was Michelle Fecteau, who won the Grand Slam just barely, beating her husband Eddie. In case you didn't connect the dots, the baby Michelle talks about in her story is Sammy, the same kid from her husband Eddie's story. Eddie and Michelle say their doors are always open. In fact, recently Eddie mentioned that they just took on two new little ones, raising the total of kids they've raised or are raising to 19. On top of that, Michelle is a union representative for the faculty and academic staff at Wayne State University in Detroit. To see a photo of Michelle, Eddie, Sammy, and the rest of the brood, at least all the ones who could fit around the table that night, visit themoth.org. And now, a final word from our Michigan Story Slam producer, Patty Wheeler, who has some advice.
I would tell somebody that's afraid to tell a story to slam that the audience is there to support you, that they are there because they want to hear stories, and that the second that you get up there and you start talking, you see their faces and you know that it's going to be okay.
That advice doesn't just go for Michigan. That advice works for any of our slam cities. That's it for this episode of the Moth Radio Hour, the special Michigan edition. We hope you'll join us next time.
Your host this hour was Jennifer Hixon. Jennifer also directed the stories in the show. We'd like to thank WDET, Michigan Public Radio, and our regular Michigan Story Slam hosts, Satori Shakur and Alex Trajano. The rest of the Moss directorial staff includes Catherine Burns, Sarah Haberman, Sarah Austin Jeunesse, and Meg Bowles. Production support from Whitney Jones. Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Other music in this hour, Willie Williams' Detroit Blues, and the rest from Sufjan Stevens' album, Greetings from Michigan. You can find links to all the music we use at our website. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by PRX. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.